The Tolkien Road, Episode 238, The Lost Road and Other Writings. Hey there, fellow travelers. Welcome to The Tolkien Road, Episode 238. Greta, what's up?
Hey. What's up? You know what? Every episode, I think I'm gonna come up with a really cool answer to John's "What's up?" question this week, and I don't think it's this week, unfortunately. So not much is my answer.
Well, I'll tell you what's up.
Okay.
The shorter theme song.
Oh.
I edited
it. You did edit it.
Finally got around to editing the theme song. So.
Well, then that worked out well.
Yeah. So you didn't have to kill as much time on this one.
Awesome.
So, yay.
Yeah, super.
Yeah, so on this episode, we are continuing our journey through the History of Middle-earth series as we survey Volume 5, The Lost Road and Other Writings. So, The Lost Road and Other Writings, for those of you watching the video of this episode, that's this one right here. Right? Boom. Before we get started, we'd like to give a shout out to our patrons. Special thanks to this episode's executive producers, Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien, Lise Yu, Andrew T, John R, and Ms. Anonymous.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Thank you all so much. And thank you to all of our patrons who support this
Indeed.
Podcast.
Indeed.
You too can become a patron of the Tolkien Road by visiting patreon.com/Tolkien Road. Becoming a patron lets you support the show in a tangible way and land you some awesome perks, like audio recordings of my two books, Tolkien's Requiem and Tolkien's Overture. Check it out now to learn more about all the exciting perks we offer. And don't forget, you can now make an annual pledge and get 1 month free. So
good deal.
Yes, indeed. Mm-hmm. Subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes and other podcasting platforms. Leaving us a 5-star rating and a review helps get the word out about us. You can be like this anonymous person, the person whose name I don't know, but I'm going to read their review, who left the most recent 5-star review for us on Apple Podcasts. Title of this one is "Really Enjoying the Podcast." So thank you for really enjoying the podcast, and sorry we don't know your name, but it's not available to me for some reason and the reference I'm using. However, this is the review. As a lifelong Tolkien fan, I tried a few Tolkien podcasts before settling on this one. After listening to several episodes, I realized that it was that time again. Lost count long ago of how many times I've read the books, but now I'm reading them again. The podcast is very interesting in that it contrasts the response of John, a serious longtime fan, with that of Greta, a Tolkien newbie keen to learn. I particularly like that the podcast takes a serious look at the books chapter by chapter. Some of the others I tried were more focused on discussing the movies. Still on the Silmarillion episodes, so a long way to go. Yeah, you do have a long way to go, yeah. So it might be a while before you hear us giving you a shout-out here on episode 238. But we thank you for leaving your note, and thanks for, I'm delighted to hear that our Tolkien podcast stood out amongst the other ones for you. So that's cool.
Definitely.
I wasn't aware that many of the others seem to focus on the movies a lot, but you know, I'm glad that makes us distinctive because I'm all about Tolkien first.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Same.
But hopefully you enjoy our movie episodes as well when you get to them. So, or maybe not, maybe you just hate the movies and you won't even bother with those. But anyway, thanks for leaving an awesome review.
Yeah.
Awesome 5-star review.
Thank you.
You can also check our YouTube channel there. You can watch this. You can watch all of our episodes. Well, our latest episodes on YouTube. Now I think it's going back almost to the beginning of this year's run of episodes that are now available for you on YouTube, as well as some other past episodes we've done. We managed to record. And I've got various other videos on our YouTube channel, always trying to grow that. So check out, you can check it out by going to TolkienRoad.com/YouTube or just going to YouTube and searching for the Tolkien Road podcast on there and you'll find us. And make sure you subscribe to us and click that notification bell, right? So, and then you're going to know, and you know, I'm thinking about how we can get our YouTube, YouTube followers maybe a little more involved over there. I'm thinking about trying trying to do like a live stream or something like that over on YouTube and, you know, seeing if we can get some more interaction as we record live for people. So,
I'm down.
We might try that at some point here in the not too distant future, and we'll let y'all know about it when we do. So
Cool beans.
Yeah. So stick around to the end of the episode for correspondence. Greta, yeah. You ready to do this?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. On this episode, we are surveying Volume 5 of the History of Middle-Earth series, The Lost Road and Other Writings. While the first four volumes focused on the early development of Middle-Earth's First Age, Volume 5 shines a light on the origin of the Second Age, the era of Numenor. However, there's also...
I like Numenor.
Yes, I do too. And there's also a lot of material focused on the First Age, and we'll get to that. But the title, The Lost Road, is really referring to the genesis of the Numenorean myth, right? So, the genesis of the Second Age stories. So much of what we've been looking at so far has been focused on the First Age stories of Middle-Earth. And then the Second Age, of course, is Numenor, and we're going to start to get into where that came from today.
Cool. So is this could somewhat be relatable to the Latron Prime series?
Yes, I would say so. That's a great point. So this is, you know, this is actually getting very interesting, just turning up our volume so we can hear ourselves a little better. This is, you know, what's may have seemed like something that people would not even care about, like most people would not even care about in the past, is getting to the point where it might actually become very relevant in the not too distant future with the Lord of the Rings on Prime TV show focusing on the Second Age. So I'm excited, you know, to learn more about this. And I will say, after reading just a little bit of The Lost Road, I'm kind of disappointed Tolkien didn't write more of this story, right? I liked the style of it, and I think it could have been really cool, but it eventually evolved into the Numenorean legend, and it took on a life of its own. But I think it, you know, this, not this whole volume, but the Lost Road legend in particular could be an interesting one to come back to later on, and a really enjoyable one, not just interesting, but very enjoyable to come back to later on and just do a focused little, you know, 2-3-4 episode mini arc on, on that.
Yeah. Yeah, cool.
Yeah. So Volume 5 is divided into three parts. Part 1 is entitled The Fall of Numenor and the Lost Road. Of the Lost Road, Tolkien calls it My Father's Abandoned Time Travel Story.
A.K.A. Christopher Tolkien.
Right, Christopher. Okay. Didn't I say Christopher?
No, you said Tolkien.
Oh, I'm sorry. Christopher
just
calls
clarifying.
It My Father's Abandoned Time Travel Story. Yes. We don't have any abandoned time travel stories from J.R.R. Tolkien's father. which must have been lost in South Africa, I guess.
I'm just going to say I love time travel stories. I love them.
Cool.
So I'm excited.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, definitely we'll have to ring this up for future reference to do a deep dive on it.
Mm-hmm.
Part 2 is entitled Valinor and Middle-Earth Before the Lord of the Rings. In the preface, Christopher has this to say about Part 2. This fifth volume of the History of Middle-Earth completes the presentation and analysis of my father's writings on the subject of the First Age up to the time at the end of 1937 and the beginning of 1938 when he set them for long aside. The book provides all the evidence known to me for the understanding of his conceptions in many essential matters at the time when The Lord of the Rings was begun. And from the annals of Valinor, the annals of Beleriand, the Ainulindale, and the Quinta Silmarillion given here, it can be quite closely determined which elements in the published Silmarillion go back to that time and which entered afterwards. So basically, part two consists of his final First Age writings prior to composing Lord of the Rings. So in shortly after the publication of The Hobbit, Unwin was clamoring for a new Hobbit, and Tolkien began The Lord of the Rings at that time and spent the next 13, 14 years of his life on it and really didn't come back to the Silmarillion in a substantive way until the early 50s. So this is like basically when you think about what refers to, you know, the ages before the time of The Lord of the Rings, that stuff, especially when it comes to the First Age, that stuff was, you know, was composed in the late 30s. So this is this, like, of what we have of the Silmarillion in Lord of the Rings, this is kind of where Tolkien had landed by then when he wrote The Lord of the Rings, right? So that may be a really roundabout way of saying it, but this is the Silmarillion that was used to write Lord of the Rings, I guess you could say it that way. So, yeah. So, and then part three is entitled The Etymologies. Christopher describes part three like so. Make sure I got my place here. Here we go. He says, I include in this book the general essay called The Lamas, which is actually part of part two, or A Count of Tongues, and also the etymologies, both belonging to this period. The latter, a kind of etymological dictionary, provides historical explanations of a very large number of words and names, and enormously increases the known vocabularies of the Elvish tongues, as they were at that time, for like everything else, the languages continued to evolve as the years passed. So we get a little bit of Tolkien's etymological dictionary as it stood at this time for the various Elvish languages.
Okay.
So let's take a closer look. I should also say there are three appendices in this as well, which I won't really go into that much, but it's the genealogies, the list of names, and the second Silmarillion map. So you can check those out as well in this volume. So part one, The Fall of Numenor and the Lost Road, consists of three sections. The first section is entitled The Early History of the Legend. So in this short essay, Christopher explains how the Lost Road came about as an agreement between his father and C.S. Lewis that they should undertake to write the sorts of stories they liked. Lewis would write a space travel story. Tolkien would write a time travel story. Lewis's space travel story would eventually see publication as Out of the Silent Planet. Tolkien's would never see the light of day in his lifetime, but given that it led to the legend of Numenor, and that Numenor is set to be the subject of the most expensive TV show of all time, one might argue that Tolkien's lost time travel story has indeed turned out to be far more significant. And I say that as a fan of Lewis's and the space trilogy. So, you know, there was this news recently, which you may be a little bit inflated, but basically they're spending a ton of money on the first season of this Lord of the Rings on Prime. So my thought is that if indeed, you know, we might think and like, well, I guess nothing really came of Tolkien's story in this Lewis and Tolkien deal, but Lewis has obviously became Out of the Silent Planet. And then he wrote two sequels in the space trilogy, two sequels to Out of the Silent Planet. So you might think that Lewis's venture here was far more successful than Tolkien's, in this little deal they had with each other, but maybe not. Maybe in the end Tolkien has the last laugh on this, right? Tolkien's like rolling like Scrooge McDuck swimming in the money bin on this one, right? Of course Tolkien's not, but his, you know, the Tolkien estate and his descendants are, apparently. So it's just interesting to think about, like, you know, how it's all panned out in the end for you know, for Tolkien here. So
how the turntables have turned indeed.
So
that's interesting.
Yeah. So part two of, or section two, chapter two, whatever you want to call it, of part one is The Fall of Numenor. Christopher describes the fall of Numenor like so. This remarkable text documents the beginning of the legend of Numenor and the extension of the Silmarillion into a second age of the world. Here the idea of the world made round and the straight path was first set down. And here appears the first germ of the story of the Last Alliance. In the words, these also seek out the fading elves. How Amroth wrestled with Thu and drove him to the center of Earth. At the beginning of the text, Aglaador is named as the chief of a people living on the northwest coast of Middle-earth. The longevity of the Numenorians is already present, but even allowing for the compression and distortion inherent in such outlines of my father's, in which he attempted to seize and dash onto paper a bubbling up of new ideas, seems to have far less significance than it would afterwards attain. And it ascribed strangely to the radiance of Valinor, in which the mariners of Numenor were bathed during their visits to Tol Eressëa, to which they were permitted to sail. So that's Christopher's little description of this relatively short section of the book. But what we have here is basically the first outlines of the Second Age, recognizable to some degree as a predecessor of Akalabeth. There's an initial outline followed by two versions of The Fall of Numenor. So there's kind of an outline, you know, jotting down some notes in sequence of how the story should proceed, and then Tolkien's, a couple of attempts at Tolkien actually turning it into something like a story or a legend, right?
Isn't the Fall of Numenor in the Silmarillion?
Well, it's it's not technically a part of the Silmarillion, like, right? So that's what's confusing about calling that whole book the Silmarillion, is actually the Silmarillion is really just Quaintus Silmarillion, right? It's chapters 1 through 24 of that book, right?
Oh, okay.
And then even Ainulindale and Valaquenta are not actually technically a part of the Silmarillion, nor is Akalabeth or the Rings of Power in the Third Age. The Silmarillion story for Tolkien was originally just focused on the story of the jewels, right?
Right. Okay.
The three Silmarils.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
So Akalabeth was kind of tacked onto it and included in that volume as a chronicle of the Second Age.
I see. Okay.
Akalabeth.
And that's where we find the story of the fall of Numenor.
Right. The downfall of Numenor.
Okay.
Yeah. So.
So is this a different version than that?
It's
one?
An early version.
It's an early
right?
version. Okay.
So remember, with the Silmarillion, what we actually have, the one that we got in 1977, that was really like Christopher's experience putting that together was where this whole unfinished tales leading into the history of Middle Earth came from, right? Because he felt like he didn't really do his father's legacy justice, and because he had to make editorial
That's right.
choices and kind of
Yeah.
compile things in a certain way to make him more coherent, because his father had kind of left all of this stuff to him, and he was just like, well, people seem to be into this stuff, so I guess I'll just give him all the stuff my father did and just make some commentary on it. So
that's right. I feel like you have to remind me of that like every episode.
No, it's all good. Yeah.
I'm losing my bearings.
Yeah, well, it's easy to lose your bearings with this stuff for sure. It's like I've said in some of the previous episodes on this, it's a little bit head splitting to put together the notes on these things. I mean, and I'm not even going particularly deep into them, but it's just getting through it all. I feel like it could have been organized in a better fashion. But you know, you feel like you get to know Christopher a little bit. You get to know his personality a little bit through the process of reading these things and how they were put together.
Mm-hmm.
And you can just tell he was, absent-minded professor is not really right, because he was obviously pretty brilliant, but he was almost that kind of professorial type who's so brilliant that they're maybe a little bit difficult to relate to, right? And they speak in roundabout ways, indirect ways, that can be challenging, you
yeah.
know, for
yes.
lay people such as ourselves.
Challenging may be an understatement.
Yes. So, a little excerpt from The Fall of Numenor. The last battle of the gods, men side largely with Morgoth. After the victory the gods take counsel, elves are summoned to Valinor. Many men had not come into the old tales. They are still at large on Earth. The fathers of men are given a land to dwell in, raised by Ossé and Aule in the great western sea. The western kingdom grows up, Atlante. Its people, great mariners and men of great skill and wisdom. They range from Tol Eressëa to the shores of Middle Earth. Their occasional experience among wild men, some become lords in the east. But the gods will not allow them to land in Valinor. And though they became long-lived because many have been bathed in the radiance of Valinor from Tol Eressëa, they are mortal and their span brief. They murmur against this decree. Thu comes to Atlante, heralding the approach of Morgoth, but Morgoth cannot come except as a spirit. The Atlanteans fall and rebel. They make a temple to Thu Morgoth. They build an armament and assail the shores of the gods with thunder. So, I believe Thu is Sauron. I believe that's who that is. So, I'm not 100% sure on that, but I think that was an early name for Sauron, perhaps.
And is Atlantia another name for Numenor?
For Numenor, yeah.
Okay.
What's interesting is that apparently men could go to Tol Eressëa at this stage in the Legendarium, whereas in the final version, they're not even allowed to enter Tol Eressëa, to my understanding. Although people from Tol Eressëa do come to Numenor, right, and visit mm-hmm. Numenor. So, and correct me on that if I'm wrong, listeners, but that's my understanding. So, interesting little difference.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right. So, that's part two of, chapter two of part one. Chapter three is The Lost Road itself. So, as previously mentioned, this is a time travel story Tolkien began in the 30s and never finished. He basically completed four chapters of this work before abandoning it. The first two chapters focus on a character named Alboin, right? Something like that. Albion. Something of a figure contemporary to Tolkien himself, with similar biographical details. The second two chapters get into the legend of Numenor. Of this story, Tolkien later said, "I began an abortive book of time travel of which the end was to be the presence of my hero in the drowning of Atlantis. This was to be called Numenor, the Land in the West. The thread was to be the occurrence time and again in human families, like Durin among the dwarves, of a father and son called by names that could be interpreted as Bliss Friend and Elf Friend. It started with the father-son affinity between Edwin and Elwyn of the present, and was supposed to go back into legendary time by way of an Eadwyn and Elfwyn of circa AD 918, and Anduin and Albwyn of Lombaric legend, and so to the traditions of the North Sea concerning the coming of corn and culture heroes, ancestors of kingly lines and boats, and their departure in funeral ships. In my tale, we were to come at last to Amandil and Elendil, leaders of the loyal party in Numenor, when it fell under the domination of Sauron." So this was to kind of introduce and get into the story, but it actually, the legend of Numenor actually is the other two chapters we have of this. I don't know that it was just going to be like chapters three, Numenor is just going to be chapters three and four. I think these two chapters, which are concerned this figure, Alboin, who's more of a contemporary of Tolkien's. And then you have, he gets into two chapters, which kind of get into the story of Numenor at that point. I'm going to read a little excerpt from the first chapter, just to give you a flavor of what the story of Alboin, what this, to give you a feel for what this book or this story would have been like. So this is chapter one, A Step Forward, Young Alboin. Alboin, Alboin. There was no answer. There was no one in the playroom. Alboin. Oswin Erol stood at the door and called into the small high garden at the back of his house. At length, a young voice answered, sounding distant and like the answer of someone asleep or just awakened. Yes. Where are you? Here. Where is here? Here. Up on the wall, father. Oswin sprang down the steps from the door into the garden and walked along the flower-bordered path. It led after a turn to a low stone wall screened from the house by a hedge. Beyond the stone wall there was a brief space of turf and then a cliff edge, beyond which outstretched, and now shimmering in a calm evening, the western sea. Upon the wall Oswin found his son, a boy about 12 years old, lying gazing out to sea with his chin in his hands. "So there you are," he said. "You take a deal of calling. Didn't you hear me?" "Not before the time when I answered," said Alboin. "Well, you must be deaf or dreaming," said his father. "Dreaming, it looks like. It is getting very near bedtime. So if you want any story tonight, we shall have to begin at once." "I am sorry, father, but I was thinking." "What about?" "Oh, lots of things mixed up. The sea and the world and Alboin." "Alboin?" "Yes, I wondered why Alboin. Why am I called Alboin? They often ask me why Alboin at school, and they call me Allbone. But I am not, am I?" "You look rather bony, boy. But you are not all bone, I am glad to say. I am afraid I called you Alboin, and that is what you are called, and that is why you are called it. I am sorry, I never meant it to be a nuisance to you." "But it is a real name, isn't it?" said Alboin eagerly. "I mean, it means something, and men have been called it. It isn't just invented." "Of course not. It is just as real and just as good as Oswin, and it belongs to the same family, you might say. But no one ever bothered me about Oswin, though I often used to get called Oswald by mistake. I remember how it used to annoy me, though I can't think why. I was rather particular about my name." So that's just a little taste of what this story was like, but it's much different from what Tolkien normally wrote, right? Mm-hmm. Even what we have in Lord of the Rings, although it's a little bit more of the kind of like, you know, playful in terms of the banter and the dialogue that you get in Lord of the Rings. But this has that, it has a little bit more of a contemporary feel, right? You know, it has a little bit more of a story of just like some people in the modern world talking to each other, mm-hmm. like two people in the modern world talking to each other.
So how does the time travel get worked in? Does Alboin and his dad, like, is this a frame narrative or do they actually travel?
I think it was intended to be something like a frame narrative, but kind of a long one, right? Okay. So the other chapters we have, so the first two chapters really are focused on Alboin and sort of the story, like it's his story, mm-hmm. but it does get into talking some about like Numenor and like, my understanding is like language he's seeing in his dream, So like he's seeing these things happen in his, or like these words appear in his dreams, and he's asking his father like why these things, and that, and then there's some time that elapses and another character is brought into the story. And then the other two chapters that are in here are really just focused on, like, they would seem like you're just reading about Numenor at that point, right? Hmm. So it's not entirely clear to me how he intended to connect this to Numenor, like how it would have seeped into, you know, just talking about the stories of Numenor. My thought is that maybe Alboin somehow becomes a time traveler back to the age of Numenor.
That's what I was wondering, yeah.
Because it is supposed to be a time travel story.
Right.
So, and it might actually be in here, and that's why I say I think it'd be fun to, like, explore this story in more detail at some point, right?
Yeah.
So we can really get a good feel for where, you know, where the stories of Numenor came from.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
So,
yeah.
So, I think it would be a fascinating work to explore in more depth. And then there's some interesting poetry at the end of the chapter in addition to these chapters from a lost story. So, yeah, hopefully we'll get to that sooner rather than later. Chalk that up as one of the maybe greatest hits of the history of Middle-earth so far.
Yeah, let's put it at the top of the list, please.
Yep.
Okay.
All right, part two. Part two is entitled Valinor and Middle-earth Before the Lord of the Rings. There are six chapters in part two. The first is entitled The Texts and Their Relations, and this is a short essay by Christopher on the relationship of these texts to similar ones from volume four. So,
texts meaning stories.
Yeah, the different chapters in here, okay. Right? Chapter two of part two is entitled The Later Annals of Valinor. So remember that we had an earlier version of this in volume four. Of this, Christopher notes, Annals of Valinor version 2, this one, shows no great narrative evolution from the one in volume 4, as that text was emended. On the other hand, there are some noteworthy developments in names and conceptions. A curious feature is the retention of the original dates between the destruction of the trees and the rising of the sun and moon, which in the volume 4 version were greatly accelerated by later penciled changes, and the commentary on Annal 2992 below. Thus, for example, in AV1, the first version, as originally written, and in AV2, this one, some 10 years of the sun, one Valian year, elapsed between the Battle of Aqualondë and the utterance of the prophecy of the North, whereas in AV1, as amended, only 1 year of the sun passed between the two events. So just some little, you know, little details changed like that between the two versions. But basically, you know, this is like that timetable. Like, you know, you think of the timetable we have in Appendix B for the Second Age and the Third Age events. Well, this is supposed to be the years before the sun. So you kind of think about from Chapter 1 of the Silmarillion until roughly Chapter 9, Chapter 10. This is the annal of events that take place during those chapters, okay? So it's cool to have these. I mean, I kind of looked at this today, and I was like, now why didn't Christopher include, like, a little timetable of stuff, like, in The Silmarillion, right? Mm. I think even a timetable would have made a lot of this a lot more easy to get into for first-time readers, right? You know, you just look back on all these things, and you're like, I'm glad, Christopher, that you did the History of Middle-earth series, but it might have just been worthwhile just to kind of revisit the Silmarillion again and add some stuff, like add a frame narrative and add some timetables and some explanatory material so that it was a little friendlier for people to get into. But again, I reference what I said before about Christopher. I think he was just like, you know, just kind of brilliant to the point of, like, it wasn't easy for him to relate to the common person, or at least relate his father's stories to the common person, you know, right, to the average reader. So,
yeah.
But anyway, that's just what I gather from all of this. So, but we still see a 30,000-year period of time prior to the years of the sun. So those 10 chapters are 30,000 years. So,
wow.
Yeah, so that's how long the pre-First Age of Middle-earth was. Chapter 3 of Part 2 is entitled The Later Annals of Beleriand. So you'll recall, after the Annals of Valinor, we have the Annals of Beleriand, which are the, you know, really chapters 10, 11 through 24 of the Silmarillion. And that's a much shorter time period, right? Only a few hundred years elapse in that, few hundred normal years elapse in that. And those are really the years of the sun. Christopher on this section notes, in content, this version remains in general close to the one in volume 4, but it is not only fuller in matter, but also more finished in manner. The Annals of Beleriand was becoming an independent work and less a consolidation of the historical structure and its internal relations and chronology in support of the Quinta. But it is still annalistic, retaining the introductory Year of the Year entries derived from the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle and lacking connection of motive between events. And since, most unhappily, my father abandoned the Grey Annals at the end of the story of Turin, the conclusion of AB 2 contains the last account in the Annals tradition of the 4th, becoming the 6th century of the Sun and the Great Battle. So he actually completed this version of the Annals of Beleriand, whereas he had not completed it with the version in Volume 4.
Okay.
So yeah, he goes
so
all the way through.
So why even bother to put the unfinished one in Volume 4?
Because that's Christopher is documenting the evolution of these things, right?
Okay.
That's his intent.
He wants to see, like, the progression.
He is showing a textual history, so...
gotcha. And sorry, Christopher, it's all lost on me.
And that's what I'm here to do, folks, is explain it all to you the best I can, right?
I'm like, I don't want the unfinished version, just give me the finished one.
Yeah, it's, I feel a little bit like a, you know, like a poor man's, like, bargain cheap version of Moses here, like trying to like relate from on high, you know, the mind of brilliance, right? The mind of you know, just this, all this wonder and knowledge down to a level that's like, okay, I get it. I get what they're trying to say now. I get what this is all about now. And doing a really not very good job of it. But
you're doing your best.
I'm doing my best. Yeah.
It's best.
So
way better than I could have done, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean,
I said it. It's okay for you to agree with me.
I mean, I'm trying to do a good job here, people. So you
are.
Okay,
you definitely are.
All right. As long as you can understand it a little better than you did before, then you know, I feel good about what I'm doing here.
Good.
All right. So, chapter 4 of part 2 is Ainu Lindele. So this is only the second stab Tolkien had taken at the Middle-earth creation myth, the first having been around 1918, which was featured in the Book of Lost Tales 1, of course. Of this, Christopher says, "In all the works given in his history so far, there has been only one account of the creation of the world, and that is in the old tale of the Music of the Ainur, written while my father was at Oxford on the staff of the dictionary in 1918 through 20. The sketch of the mythology makes no reference to it, and Quenta Silmarillion and the Annals of Valinor 1 only mention in their opening sentences the making of the world, the making of all things by Iluvatar. And the Annals of Valinor in this volume adds nothing further. But now, among the later writings of the 1930s, he turned again to the tale told by Rumil to Ariel in the Garden of Mar Vanwa Tialieva in Cortirion, and wrote a new version. And it is remarkable that in this case, he went back to the actual text of the original Music of the Ainur. The new version was composed with the lost tale in front of him, and indeed he followed it very closely, though rephrasing it at every point, a great contrast to the apparent jump between the rest of the Valinorian narrative in the lost tales and the sketch, where it seems impossible that he wrote out the condensed synopsis without rereading them." So that's you know, that's what we have here with Ainu Lindele. He's revisiting it for the first time in almost 20 years, and you know, and giving us an updated version of it with updated language. So
this is similar to the one in the Silmarillion, or
closer to it, you know.
Okay. But still not the most updated.
Well, yeah, not the most updated. I'm not sure. I think he revisited it after in later years after writing Lord of the Rings, but mm-hmm. I'm not 100% sure.
Okay.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, just a quick scan of it, it looks a little closer to what we're familiar with from it, you know. Okay. But interestingly, he does retain, you know, the little fragment of the frame narrative with the Book of Lost Tales, right? Of the Cottage of Lost Play, right? So this was written by Rumil of Tún, right?
Oh,
so,
okay. That's not in the Silmarillion, though.
No,
okay.
Definitely not.
Interesting.
Yeah. All right, so chapter 5 of part 2 is called The Lammas. Not the Lammas, the Lammas. This is an account of the development of the various languages of Middle Earth. If it had been the Lammas, it might have been like an account of all of these strange beasts, which would have been kind of cool.
Yeah.
But they're not all Lammas, so it couldn't have been that. So this seems to be pretty strictly focused on Tolkien's invented languages, but within the Middle Earth historical context. So it's kind of like a history of language, right? It's a history of the development of the languages, but like given within the legendarium itself. So it's not like this is how I developed the languages. Like these are how they developed within the world of Middle Earth, right? Mm. Between the world of the, you know, of this period. So
it's a linguistic history. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, okay. Exactly. A faux linguistic history, right?
Even better.
Which again, you're just like,
okay.
Tolkien's a philologist. Yep. That man found his calling, right? There is no doubt in my mind that Tolkien found the thing that that God put him on this earth to be. Right? Mm-hmm. You know, he found that thing that he loved, and man, more power to him, right? It just makes you think if more of us could actually get into the thing that we are actually most passionate about and find a way to make a living doing that, man, like maybe like human society would just be like taken to the entire like next level of awesomeness. You know, how much talent is wasted doing things that are not the true gifts, right, of people.
Oh, that's a depressing thought. Let's move on.
No, I'm not trying to be depressing. I think it'll all work out in the end. That's part of my faith as a Christian, right? But well, and I think okay. I think just a little aside, I think that's kind of what Leaf by Niggle is about, right? Like it's about somebody being frustrated at not being able to do the thing they feel most passionate about, right? Yeah. And they feel called to. Mm-hmm. But in the end, it actually all kind of works out. And the most important thing is love, right? And how you live your life, right? And respect to others. So that was what Tolkien discovered through that story, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think that's a good call.
It's just he happens to be lucky because he actually got to do the things that he loved and finish the story that he was worried he was never going to finish. Yeah. So, all right. thanks for letting me do that little aside on Leaf by Niggle.
Yeah, you have me wanting to read that again.
Chapter 6 of Part 2 is Quaintus Silmarillion. So while there was a version of Quainta in Volume 4, we have the latest pre-Lord of the Rings version of the Silmarillion Legendarium here. From Christopher's notes, I understand that this was a version of Quainta Silmarillion Tolkien wrote after his fateful meeting with Stanley Unwin in late 1937. Of course, you'll remember he wanted Unwin to publish the Silmarillion, but Unwin wanted a Hobbit sequel. Tolkien would begin the new Hobbit a few days after their meeting, but then in early 1938 he again revised Quaintus Silmarillion, and then that's what we have here. So this is kind of the final version of what we would come to know, like what we're most familiar with is the Silmarillion. It's the final version of that Tolkien wrote before he wrote Lord of the Rings, right? So we're getting closer to the version of the Silmarillion we're all familiar with, right?
Okay. Gotcha.
And this is opposed to like in an annalistic version, right, of just a timetable of different events. This is actually like more of a narrative of, of the history of these periods.
Okay.
So.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. And then Part 3 is entitled The Etymologies. So this is essentially Tolkien's linguistic dictionary dating from this period. It seems to be a predecessor of the appendix in the Silmarillion titled Elements in Quenya and Sindarin Names. Christopher opens this section with an essay, and the rest of the chapter consists of basically an etymology of Tolkien's languages, right? So an etymology, do you know what the word etymology means, Greta?
It's like a, like where something originates.
Yeah, right. It's the history. Yeah. It's kind of like, you think of like, the Oxford English Dictionary is famous for not only being a dictionary, but also giving like the etymology of different words, right? Mm-hmm. Like where they came from. And so, that's basically what Tolkien did here. He basically gives an etymology for not just the words, but different parts of words and like where you can find like, you know, just different parts of his languages. So like, he has here,
it's kind of like a dictionary.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. So, let me just find like a random entry here. He has, we'll do alum. So, this is an elm tree. The stem is perhaps lalum, but some hold it related to Allah, since the elm was held blessed and beloved by the Eldar. And then Christopher has a note in there. But it'd be basically that's what this section consists of, right? Some of the entries are really long too. So, you know, if you're a language person, this and llamas are like right up your alley, right? Yeah. So. Did I mention Tolkien was a philologist?
I don't know. Did you?
Tolkien was a philologist. He liked language a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So Greta, that concludes our survey of The Lost Road and Other Writings.
All righty.
Yeah.
Cool. That was good.
Yeah. So as we conclude our survey of Volume 5, I want to share some thoughts so far of this whole venture through the history of Middle-earth. I have two big takeaways. First of all, Christopher did an incredible service to Tolkien fans with these works. Mm-hmm. He really did. Number two, that work is unfinished and needs to be carried forward. I'm not entirely sure what that would look like, but I, for one, believe there needs to be work to make aspects of the history series more accessible to the average Tolkien fan and to use the discoveries of these works to improve upon and carry forward the legendarium itself. I've mentioned that I like the idea of reworking the published Silmarillion to include a frame narrative, perhaps based on the original conception of the Book of Lost Tales, but instead focusing on conversations between Frodo, Gandalf, and other familiar characters from The Lord of the Rings. While publishers should be careful to ensure the legendarium of Middle-earth isn't diminished, I'm a believer that Tolkien's work can be carried forward and even adapted into forms that will delight the hardcore fans and make his other Middle-earth tales more accessible to the average reader. And I actually believe that's something he would have been okay with under the right parameters, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So I really do. I think Tolkien, you know, he wouldn't have just wanted anybody to do this stuff. But I think, you know, he was open to having others dabble in his legendarium, it would seem to me.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Anyway, I really think that could be a step towards making the Silmarillion far more accessible to people is maybe doing a second edition of it that provides a frame narrative, right? That has those relatable characters in it.
Mm-hmm.
And, would it kill publishers to do like a, here's the greatest hits from the history of Middle Earth and like kind of condense it down some and pull out some of the cool stuff, right? And make it a little more readable, maybe not have so much of Christopher's commentary and just work to make it, just a little bit more friendly. Because my point is that then you'll have more people want to get into the history of Middle-earth once they want to dive in, right? Make it a little more accessible.
You know, I haven't read the that new edition of Beren and Lúthien that came out a couple of years ago or whatever. But I'm wondering if something like that even, like pulling out some of the big stories, some other of the big kind of pivotal stories from the Silmarillion and kind of doing single book versions of them.
Right.
Might be a good idea too.
Yeah. I like that idea as well, you know, and I think maybe that's something Christopher, like maybe he realized that towards the end of his life and was like, that's why he gave us those three volumes. Right.
Mm-hmm.
I have to kind of think that's why he did. But there's so many other stories that you could do that for, you could do that same thing for. Right. So, why not have in one volume, like, you know, the history of just a Calibeth, and it's just like the development of it, right? Well, I think what can make the history of Middle Earth so challenging is that you've got, it can be so disjointed at times. Mm-hmm. You're like, you're jumping back and forth between these different things and it just doesn't flow well at all, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have to do additional work beyond just the work of reading what's written on the paper.
Right.
To make sense of it all. And right. to, unless you just have a mind that works like Christopher's, which I don't think very many people do, honestly.
Mine doesn't. That's
mine
sure.
certainly doesn't.
Yeah.
And so I have to do the work of like, okay, this is talking about this, right?
Mm-hmm.
I have to go back and read passages a couple of times. But I think there's so many different ways you could go with this. And I'm hopeful that over time there will be more openness to just finding the right people to do this work and continue to carry the work of Tolkien and of Christopher forward in new and exciting ways for the fans, right? For the big fans, right?
Mm-hmm.
And for other people who have yet to discover how great this stuff is.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, just how something is organized can just go so far into how, you know, how it's received and approached and, you know, anything like that. I mean, I think putting it in maybe more bite-sized chunks, you know, and putting things that relate to each other together, I think would be very helpful.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Well, let's do a little correspondence. We didn't get to do any correspondence last week, so we're going to touch on a little correspondence on this episode.
Sounds good.
Our first note is a comment actually left on the Podbean app, which is an app some people use to listen to podcasts, Podcatcher.
Hmm.
And it's, to my knowledge, is the first one we've ever gotten over there, although my apologies, we missed other ones. But I just thought this one was cool. So this is sent on April 18th. I don't know the name of the individual who sent this, but this is what they said. Thanks for the great podcast. Greetings from Belarus, which is fighting against local version of Sharky right now. So, well, thank you. That's awesome that you live in Belarus. Mm-hmm. And thank you for listening to our podcast and for reaching out and leaving a comment saying, hey, sorry that you're having to put up with your local version of Sharky right now. I have zero knowledge of Belarusian politics, so I hope everything's okay. I really do. I won't comment any further on that because I'd be commenting in complete ignorance. But I hope you, on a personal level, are doing okay. Mm-hmm. and take care of yourself and your loved ones and friends. So, yeah. And thanks for listening. Continue. Yeah. I hope you'll keep in touch.
Yes. So. Thanks for the note.
Mm-hmm. All right. Our next note comes from Andrew on April 17th. And Andrew says, I'm a recent listener of the Tolkien Road and I love you guys.
Oh,
awesome. Thanks, Andrew.
Yes, thank you.
Since I'm fresh to the show, I'm a bit behind and don't know what you are covering right now, but I wanted to provide a Lord of the Rings haiku for you.
That's all right. Throwback.
Throwback for sure. I love it.
Oh, Leah, that's so good.
I've thought about it. I want to start reincorporating haiku again. I feel bad that we got off the trail of doing that.
It was always
this thing that we're coming up with at the very end, like right before we record, or like, and Greta's like writing down her haiku in the middle of recording an episode.
Oh, so you're blaming me?
No, mm-hmm. I'm just saying it was something that we always put off until the last minute, and then you're like scrambling.
Well, it's funny. I feel like a lot of people liked it and a lot of people hated it.
I think it's one of those things.
Kind of a polarizing piece.
I think if you save it to the end, I just try to save the extra stuff until the end for the most part, because I've just gotten I just get the sense that some people just want to hear the content, and that's fine. Yeah. Some people just want to hear the content.
Yeah.
But then I think they're more likely, once they're into it, to like listen to what comes at the end. Right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, being a podcast host, you kind of learn as you go along, people. Anyway, I'm going to read Andrew's haiku.
Please do.
Why don't you read it, actually? Excuse me. I feel like I did all the reading earlier.
All right, sure. All right, here we go. Merry and Pippin, a Took and a Brandy Buck, brothers by action.
Nice.
Very nice.
I like it.
That.
Brothers by action.
Brothers by action.
Sweet.
Very cool. Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks a lot, Andrew. Fun. Great to hear from you. Mm-hmm. And please do keep in touch as you continue on the Tolkien Road.
Indeed.
All right. Next up is a note from Marilyn. Marilyn the Librarian from April 14th. The subject line of this one is a poetic episode.
Hmm.
Hello, Carswells. I really enjoyed your explorations of alliterative and rhyming verse forms. Beowulf was such a crucial part of the fabric of Tolkien's life, career, and writings, and a major influence on the Rohirrim. Carpenter wrote in his biography that Tolkien would begin his series of Beowulf lectures by striding into the classroom, robe flowing, up to the podium. He would fix his eyes on his students and then declaim in a loud voice the opening lines of the poem. An Anglo-Saxon, of course. Many thought that when he called out, "What?" What? Ve gardena in gear dagum, that the first word was actually quiet.
That works out.
Quiet. I love it. I love the thought of like Tolkien walking into like this classroom.
I know.
Like this robe. He's like, quiet.
Oh, I love it.
Beautiful mental image.
Mm-hmm.
It was the scalds or bards in the community who would memorize entire poems and recite them in the halls of Anglo-Saxon lords. The alliteration and repeated phrases, usually a sign that the poem in question started off as an oral rather than a written work, helped the bard remember the text. They chant the verses rather than singing them, but there have been several versions of bits of Beowulf set to classical music. And then she provides a link to Howard Hanson's Lament for Beowulf, which I'll link to in the show notes. She also says, the finished tale of Kullervo, inspiration for Turin from the Kalevala, was also intended to be chanted. And then she provides a link to the Kullervo Symphony by Finnish composer Jean Sibelius, which I'll also provide a link to in the show notes. And so she goes on to say, and if you're ever searching for an alternative word to allegory, which Tolkien wasn't fond of, his preferred alternative was applicability. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so certainly I try to remind people that Tolkien liked applicability rather than allegory. Whenever we get into discussion of that, he liked the idea of there being this multitude of applicability rather than the one-to-one sort of correspondence of allegory. Or I think he tended to think of it, and I tend to think of it. So, well, Marilyn, thank you for complimenting our episode by calling it poetic, and thanks for sending us a note and for sharing those links, and we will make sure and share them in the show notes for this podcast.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, next note is from Paul M. This was sent on April 10th. All right, and Paul says, "Hello, Tolkien readers or Tolkien roters." I just read The Silmarillion. For years, I had been afraid to, knowing people smarter than me and more in love with Middle-earth than me gave up on it. Mm-hmm. However, I found the book enchanting from page one. Frankly, I find it hard to understand why people find it so difficult to read. The many characters and pronunciations can be a slog at some points, but the story is so well told, the extra time investment in the pronunciation and character index is well worth it. I did pick up John's Silmarillion guide, but per your instructions, I didn't read the guide. Rather, I tried reading the book first without John's assistance. Now I'm going through the podcast episodes to catch up on the many details I missed. Mm. Here's my main point. You started with the Silmarillion at the very beginning of the podcast. It sounded like Greta didn't even have her own microphone. Whoops, my bad.
Did I not?
No, I was using like a little recorder, microphones at that point.
Yes, okay.
I started to get a lot of feedback that people couldn't hear you. I mean, I can hear you when I listen back to the episodes, but I think it's just you're not as much of a loudmouth as I am, first of all.
Okay.
Anyway, back to his note. You have stepped up your game since. Is there any chance you can go back down the road of the Silmarillion again? Maybe not in every chapter analysis, but have you picked up on anything new since the original podcast episodes were done? Does Greta still find the first part of A Calibeth boring, or does she now realize it is the greatest piece of writing Tolkien ever did? Greta.
Oh, geez, I'm being put on the spot.
Well, to be sure, A Calibeth isn't fresh in your mind at this point, so it may not be fair to make
you answer
that.
Is that the beginning or the end?
A Calibeth is the downfall of Numenor, right?
Oh, so it's the end.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. She'll I think you're going to hold off on your commentary.
I'm going to hold off.
Yeah.
I'm going to go back and review it. And I'll answer on the next episode.
Maybe that's what we need to do. I was talking about doing a live streaming on YouTube. Maybe we can start doing some live stream episodes where we go back and read the Silmarillion. You know, we discuss the Silmarillion, but let people participate in our discussion.
That's not a bad idea.
I don't know. Maybe we'll try that. Maybe we'll try it with a one-off here at one point of something other than Silmarillion, see how it goes. And you know, maybe that can become a way we redo the Silmarillion and include your all's feedback in it, right? I think that might be a lot of fun.
That might be fun, and I think I would definitely enjoy it more.
Yeah.
At this point, because that was kind of a tough way to start out.
Yeah.
For a Tolkien newbie like myself, so I feel like I was just treading water a lot of the time. But now that I have so much more information and lots of others of Tolkien's work to draw from, I think I would enjoy a lot more. I think it would mean a lot more to me.
Right on.
Yeah.
Well, I think you may be onto something there, Paul.
Cool.
So we'll see if we can get her to realize it's the single greatest piece of writing that Tolkien ever did.
I will. I am going to go back and reread it, and I will have an answer on the next episode.
Oh, okay. Great. A Calibeth, right?
A Calibeth.
Calibeth.
Yes.
All right. Thanks for all you do, Paul. Well, Paul, thanks for listening, and thanks for an awesome note.
Yeah,
indeed. Appreciate hearing from you.
Thank you, Paul. Thanks for reminding us, too, of how far we've come.
Yes, indeed.
It's good to know.
All right. And our last note today is from Tim D. He left a comment on one of our blog posts on April 13th. And Tim had this to say. I noticed that the poetic meter of the excerpt of the Lay of Lithien that John read sounds similar to the Song of Durin from the Fellowship of the Ring. And some of the lines are similar or identical as well. The Lay of Lithien came first, implying that the Song of Durin was heavily influenced by the older work. Here are some of the lines that seemed most similar. A king he was on carven throne in many pillared halls of stone, there beryl, pearl, and opal pale, and metal wrought like fish's mail. Buckler and corslet, axe and sword, and shining spears were laid in hoard. And that's from A Journey, chapter 4 of book 2, A Journey in the Dark from Lord of the Rings. So, yeah.
Those lines are the same. So that's the Lay of Lythian that you just read?
Yeah, they sound very similar, to what we saw.
The Song of Doran.
Yeah, to the Lay of Lythian. So that's from the Song of Doran.
That's from the Song of Doran. Okay, gotcha.
Yeah. Oh, good catch.
Yeah.
Good catch there, Timothy. So that's interesting detail. I mean, it was all Tolkien's work, so why wouldn't, he's like, well, I've got this. It hasn't seen the light of day yet, so might as well use this. Right.
Mm-hmm.
He probably didn't expect it at that point. You know, he's like, no one's going to buy my epic poem based on a story they don't even know. Right. So maybe I'll just recycle some of this content and put it
might
here.
As well.
So,
might as well.
More power to him.
Yeah,
right?
Definitely.
Yeah. Well, good catch, Timothy.
Yes,
thanks for sharing that.
That is cool. Very
all
cool.
Right. Well, great feedback this week, guys. We'd love to hear from you. TolkienRoadPodcast@gmail.com. You can go to TolkienRoad.com, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, etc. Hey, let us know if you like that idea of doing a live stream, maybe doing a one-off episode here in the not-too-distant future, and if you'd be up for joining us on that live stream. Because the thing with a live stream is it's going to go better the more we have you all, a lot of people on there live with us to participate and leave comments and that kind of thing. So
we have to time it right, too.
That's right.
Yeah. Time of day and day of the week and all that.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great idea, though. I hope it works out.
I do, too. We'll have to do a little pilot episode here in the not-too-distant future.
Sounds good.
All right. Well, thanks for listening, you guys. On our next episode, we will continue our survey of the history of Middle-earth with Volume 6, The Return of the Shadow, which begins a 4-volume tour of the history of the Lord of the Rings. So maybe getting into something a little bit more relatable at this point, but we're going to find, some interesting details along the way about the origins of the Lord of the Rings. So hopefully you're pretty excited to learn more about that.
I know I am.
All right. Well, cool. I'm glad you were. All right. Well, that's all for this episode. Thank you to our amazing patrons, especially the following: Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien,
Lee Sue,
Andrew T,
John R,
Ms. Anonymous,
Shannon S,
Brian O,
Emilio P,
Zeke F,
James A,
James L,
Chris L,
Chuck F,
Azia V,
Ish of the Hammer,
Teresa C,
David of Pints with Jack,
Jonathan D,
Eric S,
Joey S,
Eric B,
Matt L,
Johanna T,
Sam N,
Mike M,
Durenayer,
Robert H,
Paul D,
and Jacob S.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you all so much. Yes. And shout out to Jonathan D, who is celebrating his patron anniversary this month.
Awesome.
So, the month of April. So,
good.
All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody, and we will talk at you next time.
Bye, y'all.
Bye-bye.